Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. In Salt Lake City, record spending boosts police budgets. What has Utah's capital gotten for it? And how pro-Latter-day Saint podcasts defend and divide the faith and the faithful. Those are some of the headlines we'll be talking about on the program today. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. In this next segment, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad. Here's the headline. In Salt Lake City, record spending boosts police budgets. What has Utah's capital gotten for it? I wanted to start with that story. Tony Semerad, thanks for joining us.
Hey, you bet. Thank you, Tom.
So you note in the story that there's been intense focus on a new public safety plan, but you also note that police in Salt Lake City have been receiving, I guess, more resources, more money for quite some time now.
Yeah, you know, the city's strategy with the police department kind of splashed into the headlines in January of this year, at the start of this year, with this new public safety plan, you know, kind of prodded by some involvement with state legislative leaders, kind of urging the mayor to act. But in fact, the Salt Lake Police Department, which is the largest police force in the state, the largest municipal police force, has actually been on the city council and the mayor's radar in terms of funding almost since 2020, when Aaron Mendenhall first took office. There's been a huge increase in the amount of spending on the police department, something like a two-thirds increase, going from $82 million that first year, 2020, to $135 million for the police department in the most recent budget cycle, which calculates out to about a 64% increase. And it's also a much, you know, generally a larger share of the city's overall budget now is taken up by the police force. So we started noticing some pretty dramatic numbers there.
Where's this money gone? What, I guess, more officers probably, where else?
Yeah, I mean, that has been the primary imperative. The mayor noted to us in an interview that when she took the helm at City Hall in 2020, that we the city ranked about at the middle in terms of what the, you know, statewide, the 50th percentile in terms of what Utah's capital pays its police. So with that sort of increase in better, you know, improving pay for officers, they've also caught up, if you will, on some longstanding vacancies in the department. There's been about a 10% increase in the number of officers since 2020. We're at 784 full-time positions on the police force, of whom about 630 are sworn officers. And that number, well, that number, you know, if you go back to Ralph Becker or Jackie Biskupski days in terms of past mayors, that number is substantially increased. It was, you know, 533 or something like that when Biskupski was office. And it was about 711 full-time positions when Mendenhall took over. So they fleshed out the ranks. They're paying officers better. There have been a number of significant salary and benefit increases for the police force under Mendenhall. And then there's also been this fascinating spending on technology. We've got new cameras coming online. There are drones being increasingly used in sort of first response kind of situations to go kind of scope you know, potential police calls, that sort of thing. There's also been a pretty dramatic increase in proactivity, as the city measures it, by police officers. And this is not necessarily police calls, but where an officer is in the field, sees something and does something about it, sort of initiates law enforcement on their own. Those numbers are up dramatically. And then, of course, there's been a more A diversified response with the public safety plan. Police officers responding to a situation are often more integrated with social workers, more integrated with youth workers, social service providers, and we're asking a lot of police that respond to situations these days. And so there's been a lot of this money has gone for additional staffing in that regard.
Yeah, skipping a bit ahead in your story, there's a support organization, I guess, for the police, and a representative from that organization mentioned that, right? That we're expecting police officers to be social workers and mental health professionals and everything bound up into one.
Yeah, this is a representative of the Salt Lake Police Foundation, which supports a nonprofit that supports officers. And yes, indeed, they are saying, look, you ain't seen nothing yet in terms of what the financial needs of a department in a growing city are really going to look like, that there's a lot more on the horizon in that regard.
So, what are the metrics by which the city is measuring whether or not this spending has been successful, these increases?
Well, there's of course a tracking of overall crime rates as sort of broken down in terms of what they report to what all police departments report to federal authorities. We are seeing compared to 3-year averages, overall crime is both violent crime and property crime are down on that sort of 16-year low with regard to those same kind of overall crime statistics. But if you look at some of the year-to-date stuff, there has been a little bit of an uptick in violent crime, and so those are some of the metrics that are being kind of applied as we look at how successful or the latest public safety plan has been. Jail bookings are up relatively dramatically. If you look at that trend going back to 2020, we do have this metric on officer proactivity, if you will, which we mentioned before, where officers are just sort of reacting in the moment. That measure of proactivity is up about 7% from last year. And then, kind of highlighting some of the aspects that the on the ground that the public service plan or the public safety plan, rather, it was specifically supposed to address. There's been a huge upswing in citations for illegal camping, calls for service in some of the focus areas that the city has designated along the Jordan River, along Main Street downtown, and then in the kind of ballpark neighborhood, calls for service and misdemeanor citations in those areas are all up fairly dramatically. And in sort of report card fashion, the city is regularly posting a lot of these same metrics and sort of a public dashboard in an effort to be transparent about the effectiveness of some of this spending.
There's discussion in your story about the repeat offenders, right? The police chief's talking about certain individuals, a group. You take them to jail, release them, and then they're just back after a while. What are they trying to do with this?
Well, that's actually been a pretty sort of fascinating emerging aspect of the public safety plan, along with additional collaboration with folks at the county and the district attorney's office and folks at the jail and social service providers. These of various representatives of different layers of government have started to react to some of the data that they are gathering and have turned up a kind of a core, if you will, of most frequent repeat offenders that seem to be taking up an inordinate share of kind of public resources, as Police Chief Brian Redd has outlined to lawmakers. They're kind of going to jail and being released and going to jail and being released and have high needs with regard to kind of mental health and substance abuse issues and behavioral issues, and they're really responsible for kind of an outsized share, these repeat offenders, of the overall impact of homelessness and, street level drug trafficking and illegal encampments and that sort of thing. And there has started to develop a system for tracking these specific individuals, and that is starting to kind of inform not only the public safety strategy, but from some of the broader policy moves by state lawmakers with regard to, how do we best address the needs of these particular people that are just such chronic users of the criminal justice system, and seem to kind of highlight the ways in which the system itself is ineffective.
Finally, in this story, there will likely, you note in your story, be a need for even greater spending, increases in spending. There's a proposed new homeless campus in Salt Lake City, and tell me about the police's role in that.
Yeah, well, sort of as that major kind of announcement sinks in, and we start to look at what some of the potential impacts may be, and again, the Utah legislature has tentatively designated a site on the west side for about a 1,300-bed homeless campus. So they've chosen the location, but there is still a lot forthcoming. To be forthcoming in terms of how this is going to be paid for. And at one recent hearing, some of the city officials that are dialing in just what the impact of a homeless campus like this might be on the city are starting to project or to estimate some pretty kind of staggering numbers in addition to the 784 positions that we talked about earlier at the police department. They're talking about adding up to 50 more, just to kind of meet the needs of this homeless campus. And as they're talking as much as $7.4 million a year to cover the full costs of, calls to the campus, potentially a new police substation, additional equipment for police. The city's fire department has also weighed in on this. They're looking at potentially up to 23 additional employees just to kind of, keep the homeless campus in whatever form kind of protected, with about a $2.7 million per year cost estimate on facilities and equipment and that sort of a thing. This is, of course, just the city's part of all of that, and city officials acknowledge that these are very general sort of initial estimates on what this campus could cost. But nonetheless, just in terms of basic magnitude of what this additional hiring and spending may involve, this is a pretty significant impact that we're already talking about. The legislature hasn't even crunched down on some of the basic questions about, kind of what would the approach of the homeless campus be specifically, how would it be paid for, how's it going to be built, and what sort of phasing, and what and how will the state address the impact on the surrounding neighbors.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. We just have a couple minutes left to get your 2-minute version of this story, that Salt Lake City won't delay a second wave of $85 million for park upgrades. So tell me very briefly where this money is coming from and where it's going to go.
Well, some of your listeners will recall a successful bond, general obligation bond that passed in 2020 overwhelmingly by about 70% in Salt Lake City, which set $85 million aside for a bond issuance to pay for park improvements across all seven districts of the city, all seven council districts. So these were to be evenly spread. There was sort of an initial issuance of some of that money, about $25 million of it. A lot of that money in that initial round has gone towards planning and design of what these new features in many of the parks might look like. And in the meantime, the council has become a little wary of the additional costs to taxpayers that these waves of bond revenues might represent. There was a little bit of a tamping of the brakes prior to a discussion last week. The council has now given a tentative thumbs up. We'll likely vote officially on it in January to issue about another 50 million of that 80-50 of that $85 million in bond stuff, bond money. And this tranche, as it's called, this wave of bond financing, is where the dirt is actually going to start to fly. There's a second phase to Glendale Regional Park. There are improvements to Fairmont and Sunnyside and Jefferson and Cottonwood and Warm Springs parks that are envisioned with this additional 50 million. Some of those concerns with regard to the impact on taxpayers are still there on the council, but there was a 6-to-1 vote recently to have that portion of the bond proceed and start showing up on taxpayers' bills and get some of these parks projects done. There is a feeling in the public and frankly among elected officials that some of these projects have lagged a little bit given the huge public support in 2022, and so that they, to sort of restore public trust a little bit, that we kind of need to get going on some of these park plans, and that is what they have put in motion.
All right. Thank you so much for telling us about both of these stories. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Thank you. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And following a break, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Here's the headline: How Pro-Latter-day Saint Podcasts Defend and Divide the Faith and the Faithful. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And in this part of the program, we welcome in Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Appreciate you taking some time. Interesting story. Here's the headline: How Pro-Latter-day Saint Podcasts Defend and Divide the Faith and the Faithful. So let's start, Tamara, how you do in your story with a statement, I guess a call, a plea from Latter-day Saint Apostle David A. Bednar. This was 2014.
Yeah, so he was speaking at Education Week at Brigham Young University, and he told his audience, "I exhort you to sweep the earth with messages filled with righteousness and truth." This was specific. He was speaking specifically about social media, and this was repeated. It was printed in the church's publications, so it went beyond just this audience. And I think it is fair to say, based on, we've quantitative research, thanks to a digital humanities scholar out of Purdue University named Spencer Stewart, and he has looked at this. And the number of podcasts and content creators, specifically on YouTube, he has looked at. But I think the trend is true across platforms that are pro-church, pro-LDS church, that is, has absolutely exploded since in the intervening 10, 11 years.
So he's actually quantified this as best he could. Give me an idea of some of the numbers.
Yeah. So he identifies three different time periods. He says that, but in the 2010 to 2014, there were about 100 of these church-friendly YouTube channels. That nearly doubles to 2015 to 2019, so just after this call. And then for the period of 2020 to 2025, it doubles again to more than 430 that, he has identified. There might be more out there. And you might say, yes, that's true, but content creation has, the number of creators out there has grown generally, and that is true. And while I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, he also looked at the number of critical channels. And those grew as well, but not the exponential growth of these pro-LDS church platforms.
So one phenomenon here is that the church, I think, has liked to control their message. They're quite good with their social media and other outlets. And so, you know, kind of a top-down church. But now you have a lot of bottom-up messages, many, many, many messengers, albeit pro-church, right, out there. Do we know what the church thinks about this? Any officials talked about this?
Well, I think there's a tacit permission given in the Bednar speech, which is to say, go for it, right? You do your thing. I think there's a certain allowance there because, of course, there's going to be a certain diversity of thought within any large group of people. What is interesting, though, is hearing this perspective of one of those who are part of this growth. His name is David Snell. My colleague Dylan Eubank interviewed him. And David Snell, who got his start on the hugely popular Saints Unscripted before starting his own Keystone podcast, said that, you know, at the beginning, he did get a sense, and he started around, I think it was 2017. At the beginning, he did get a sense that there was perhaps a little bit of hand-wringing at the top, but that has changed. And that, broadly speaking, the institution has gotten behind and on board with the many of these content creators and podcasters.
One of the experts you talked to in the story notes that some of these folks are getting quoted in church, and seminary teachers are quoting them.
Right. Yeah. Especially podcasters who produce shows that are geared around and tailored to what the church's Sunday school manual. So there is a manual that no matter where you are in the church, everyone is studying the same passages of scripture. This is a huge opportunity for podcasters, including Brigham Young University professors, as well as just rank and file members, seminary and institute teachers who have used this institutionalization in order to promote and interpret the scriptures on their own platforms. And so what happens is you have this diversity coming in here where they're all following the same guidebook, but what they choose to emphasize varies.
So in terms of sheer numbers, the church's own platform, for example, their own YouTube channel, something like 2.5 million subscribers or something, right? And then the next most popular pro-LDS podcast would be in the, what, tens of thousands or something. So there's still a difference, but a lot of these podcasts are quite popular, right?
Hundreds of thousands.
Oh, hundreds of thousands. Okay.
And you have some that are punching up against the 300K mark. Absolutely. The church remains its official LDS channel, a behemoth within the messaging of the church. We cannot undermine that. However, it is not, according to the research done by Spencer Stewart, our friend out of Purdue, the main location where conversation is taking place when it comes to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on YouTube. That is happening increasingly within other and on the pages and in the channels of these other channels, these other podcasters, some of whom hew very closely to the church's narrative, whether it's the church historical narrative, the different topics that church leaders are emphasizing. And those that do not, those that tend to color outside the lines a little bit more, often wading into these esoteric, even apocalyptic themes. These are also individuals that tend to be more partisan, which is and conservative. They tend to be more critical of the brethren, even though they see themselves as extremely faithful. But these are getting some of, while their subscriber rates are much smaller, we're talking 70,000, 60,000, their comment sections are massive. It means that their audience is engaged and has a sense of shared identity.
These, so you're talking about the kind of the two subcategories that Stuart came up with, right? Faithful core versus faithful alternative.
That's right. The faithful core are entities like Scripture Central, Saints Unscripted. They're very, like I said, they hew closely to the church's talking points, to the church's rhetoric. And then you have the faithful alternative with entities like Word Radio and A Thoughtful Faith that are tend to be much. Their approach tends to be a little bit more buttoned down and even can be quite reactionary and will criticize, for example, BYU for being too liberal and President Nelson for getting the COVID vaccine. These are some of the markers of this subcategory of pro-church influencers, podcasters, who Spencer Stewart has identified as the faithful alternative.
So I don't know, Stuart or somebody in your story says that if you have a Venn diagram right now of the two, there's a lot of overlap, but they think that it's going to be separating, that the two categories, subcategories, are going to be separating over time.
Yes, so he has been watching the divergence over the last several years. And he has done this by analyzing the unique IDs of the individuals on YouTube who are commenting on these different channels. And there was once a time where commenters in the faithful core were also listening to and commenting on shows in the faithful alternative side of things, and vice versa. That is becoming less and less the case. These two groups, and to be clear, the hosts themselves don't use these terms or identify with these buckets. This is classification that Stewart has observed through his analysis of millions of comments. And so he has found that these commenters are increasingly becoming siloed from one another and anticipates that will continue to the point that they will split into two entirely different circles and that there might be further splitting happening, that we might get even more subcategories that are taking shape.
Give me a sense of the style of course, it's probably different according to the podcaster, but there's, I imagine some that are pretty buttoned up, and others that we mentioned the story that's kind of more freewheeling, kind of a Joe Rogan type vibe.
That's exactly right. You have some of these that you'll tune in, and it's these shaven fit, clean face, no facial hair, and they've got the missionary part and the white shirt buttoned up and the tie and the suit jacket, and they're standing in front of a whiteboard, and you're basically, it's like you're back for those who went at BYU, or you're in a seminary building, and it's just exactly meant to recreate that experience. On the other hand, you have some of these others. Word Radio especially kind of gives off this sort of round table. There's some comedians or aspiring comedians there that host that show, and there's a lot of riffing, there's a lot of beards, a lot of jokes about triggering feminists and They tend to be pretty supportive of Trump and wading into partisan politics in the way that the church doesn't and that the church actively avoids. The other thing that you will find in these, in terms of aesthetics, is the music. The music will come in and it's like rock or just heavy guitar and drums in the background. And you would not, from the very beginning, it sets a very different tone from the sort of Latter-day Saint aesthetic of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Very interesting. Yeah. Anything else you want to say about the story?
It's just a space to watch. People, I mean, they're getting views. Some of these influencers are getting views in the hundreds of thousands, and in some case, even cracking a million on their videos. They're highly influential, and yet, because of our incredibly fragmented media landscape, and this is broadly speaking, a lot of people don't know you might talk to your mother-in-law who's a member of the church, and none of these names will be familiar. And yet you have a million plus views on videos.
I guess they all use the hashtag pro-LDS.
That generally has been what I've seen is how people make themselves searchable within this community.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. We just have a couple minutes left. I'd like to maybe get the quick version of this story, how LDS women serving missions at 18 might impact colleges, marriage ages, and birth rates. So this was recently announced. Young men have been able to serve at 18 for some time, young women at 19. Now the ages are equalized. A place to start briefly, colleges. What are colleges saying? They bracing for a decrease in students?
Temporary. None of them see this as somehow, a huge problem coming down the pipeline for them, for their numbers. But yes, some of them, not all, did cite a dip the last time there was an age change, but that was temporary, and that there will probably be something similar this time around.
So you talked to Susan Madsen, Utah Women in Leadership Project. She's at USU. She says she thinks this will be good for those young women as students. Go on their mission first, come back, they're more mature, maybe better students.
Yes, she believes that this is, and she's looked at, there's some research that has come out of BYU on this topic that shows that young women who have struggled maybe a little bit academically, who go on missions, come back and to do better and to seek out more difficult and competitive tracks in their studies.
What are young women generally saying? They find this positive?
They're excited. I mean, this just gives them options, right? It gives them the ability to weigh what they feel like is best for them, because 1 year may not seem like a lot, but when it's that year at that 18 to 19 year, that's a really awkward stage for many of them who are trying to decide whether or not to go to a year of school or just go straight or to work for a year before going into, it's an awkward gap for many of them.
Now, some have speculated, I guess you in your story, that the reason for disparity in the age gap is to try to head off romantic liaisons between male and female missionaries. That seems to not be a concern here, equalizing the ages.
It doesn't. Yeah. I mean, what Latter-day Saint, active Latter-day Saint, hasn't heard that in the topic of missionary age, but here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, brief treatment of that story. I'll urge you to go and read that, how LDS women serving missions at 18 might impact colleges, marriage ages, and birth rates. Go read the other story as well about the pro-LDS podcasts. We've been talking with Tamara Kemsley, who is religion reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Tamara, thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we thank the reporters who have joined us today, Tony Simmerad and Tamara Kemsley. We have some time left in the program because one of the Salt Lake Tribune reporters who was to have joined us today got sick. And so we hope that they get better soon. They were not able to join us. So what we're going to do, following a break, we're going to turn to a portion of a conversation that I had with writer Michael Kleber Diggs. This was in October. Michael Kleber Diggs was in Logan for Stokes Nature Center. And you can find that full conversation that we broadcast on our website, upr.org. But this that we're going to present following a break, we were not able to broadcast because of time constraints. Very interesting discussion about his essay from a couple of years ago titled, Why I'm Quitting Twitter. We'll talk about social media and free speech following a brief break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. As I mentioned before the break, one of the reporters scheduled for today got sick. So unfortunate for them. I hope they get better soon, so not able to join us today. So that opens up some time to present a segment from a conversation that I'd been hoping to present. We were not able to present this part of the conversation because of time in October when we broadcast this. This is a conversation with the writer Michael Kleber Diggs. Stokes Nature Center Logan brought him in as a part of their participation in NEA's Big Read. And they're reading You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. And so in that conversation, Michael Kleber Diggs and I talked about poetry in the natural world. We also talked about his fascinating upcoming memoir about his complicated relationship with lap swimming. That's a forthcoming next year, to be titled My Weight in Water. We talked about many things. And again, you can find that at upr.org. Here's part of the conversation we were not able to get to because of time. He wrote an essay in 2022, fascinating essay titled Why I'm Quitting Twitter. And we get into a conversation here about social media and free speech. Here's that portion of my conversation with poet, essayist, literary critic, and arts educator Michael Kleber Diggs. You have an essay called Why I'm Quitting Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is from 2022. And so you talk about that the marketplace of ideas has maybe always been a flawed idea, right? Mm-hmm. Marketplace,
right.
Making money off this stuff. But you say that ideal, if it ever existed, contains some components, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has a chance to speak. Everybody has a chance to hear everybody.
Right.
And everybody's operating in good faith.
In good faith.
Now, if you think about Twitter or a lot of social media, almost none of those is present. So tell me, what were some of your concerns?
Yeah, it's a net negative for me. I think when you monetize a thing, we talk about the marketplace now, that, of course, is going to shape a particular kind of perspective on it. I think that there are some among us who recognize that this is a tool through which they can exert tremendous influence over how people perceive what's happening in the country. So algorithms promote content that will keep us engaging with the platform and the technology. And because that's the case, we are residing in bubbles. I've had this idea for a while that if you're learning about your neighbor from someone else, what you're learning is likely a lie. That the best way to get to know someone is to sit down with them and to have a conversation with them. And notice in that kind of a conversation, there is no external curation. There's no, well, I wish I could say that. I wish I could hold on to that. I think right now the problem would be that for many of us, if when we sat down to do that, we would carry with us into that conversation all of the flawed assumptions that have been shaped by our engagement on social media platforms like Twitter and X, where we are taught to think of Republicans as X and Democrats as Y, and to flatten people down into categories instead of seeing them as individuals. But if we could imagine a better frame for communication, what we would build, I think, would be in person. It would be a setting where we had an opportunity to share and listen. Maybe I should flip the order there to listen and share, but that we're knowing people as individuals and not as a person who lives in a city versus a person who lives in a rural setting, a person who lives in a red state versus a person who lives in a blue state, a person who's black versus a person who's white, a person who's queer versus a person who's straight, that we're thinking about people as Tom or Michael, and we're meeting them in that kind of a setting. But I think of social media. I would add AI to this too, just while I'm on my soapbox here, as analogous to Frankenstein. We've created this thing and then we've launched it. And now we're figuring out or trying to figure out what it is or what kind of harm it might cause. Frankenstein is way more nuanced than that. The monster is full of despair and wrestling with these large existential questions. But we have a tendency to make things and launch things and then figure out what they might allow. And some people are thinking this is going to be really great. Like, I think all of us have had the experience on social media of reconnecting with a friend that we lost touch with in high school and having access to their family and their photos and their life and how cool that is. And we've also been on these platforms persuaded away from our best selves. And I was concerned about that. And that's kind of what motivated that essay.
And you point out that, you know, the companies have learned the best way to monetize social media is, you know, primal responses, anger, division, yeah. Right? So social media, and you talked about AI, is it redeemable? Is, you know, you talk about content moderation as being necessary, but that seems to, seems like companies are going away from that.
I'm going to say no. I don't think it's redeemable, but here's the inner optimist. I do think how we engage with it is. In other words, I think that we can learn to spot the effort to manipulate is the word that keeps coming, but the effort to manipulate us. I think we can be more aware of when it's happening, how it's happening, and why it's happening. And I would hope that we could, as a result of that, be less persuaded by its how the elements of it that have been corrupted. We're a long way away from that. I think it's a different kind of education. It's rooted in critical thinking, the ability to kind of be thoughtful about material or information before we take it in. Where is it coming from? How adequately sourced is it? What kind of bias is it bringing forward? Why? I think that we can be better and defend ourselves against it. And I worry that we're quite a long ways away from that. I'm ultimately interested in how can we spend more time in each other's company. I think that ends up creating a bigger kind of difference. Mm-hmm. I can think of times in my life when my perspective about people was changed by time in their presence.
Yeah, you mentioned in this essay that you're conflicted, that you do like the part of social media, the social part, right?
Mm-hmm.
You find out what your friends are doing, your family, right? You're suggesting in person's maybe best.
Yeah, I'd love to kind of get back to that. And there's a lot of cool sociology about how, you know, we're not in bowling leagues at the same rate. We're not playing volleyball together, and book clubs are declining a little bit, or they're changing. They're becoming online book clubs. And there's some cool things about that, too. It's really easy in the modern world, I think, to be separated from people physically. And to engage a lot through technology I'd love to see us change that. And if I can bring all of it to full circle, I think one of the ways that we can do that is by being outside together in nature. I've been delighted to learn about Stokes and the Nature Center and the work that they do and the way that it brings people together and invites them to spend time outdoors and to learn there and do things like that. And I find myself craving more of that, more time together. And I think also more time together with people who we initially think we might not have a lot in common with.
Well, so leave it there. Michael Kleber Diggs. You can find him at michaelkleberdiggs.com. And such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and grateful to be able to broadcast that portion of my interview. Wasn't able to do that earlier in October. You can find the rest of my conversation, Michael Kleber Diggs, poet, essayist, literary critic, and arts educator, at upr.org. Search under Access Utah. Access Utah, by the way, my program is heard in the same hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Thanks for listening today. Hope you'll join me again this same time next week.